And welcome to episode 12 of the instruction booklet. My name is Jeremy. I am your host, and I'm joined always by a man who now uses procedural generation for every single aspect of his life. It's my co-host, Michael. Michael, what's going on?
Yeah, there's been an adjustment period, you know?
Yeah.
I can no longer think for myself. In fact, everything that I'm saying right now is AI generated.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't expect anything new or original from me today, folks.
Just constantly eating stuff from the internet.
I will just be, I'm just going to be regurgitating exactly what is already readily available to everyone on the internet.
Yeah. Well, for folks that don't know, this is our 1 year anniversary show. Hey, we made it a year, Michael.
Yeah. It's crazy. I wouldn't have even remembered it that this was. I feel like we started like yesterday.
You know? I know. We've still been rolling and haven't killed each other yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it helps that we live in different states. You know,
that's also very true. So, but the show's made it a year. Hopefully, at the beginning of this episode, you heard like a new theme song. There will be some new artwork as well. We're just plowing straight into a second season. Y'all can't get rid of us yet. So, Michael, as normal, we start off. What you been up to lately? What you been reading? What you been playing? What you been watching? What kind of media you been ingesting?
Yeah, so Fallout, the TV show, really good.
That's what I hear.
Huge fan. Yeah, I love the, I'm a huge fan of the Fallout games. 1 and 2 and then New Vegas, especially. I had a soft spot for 3 when it first came out, but it has not aged well for me. I feel like, I mean, 3 has its fans, obviously, but
right.
I think the writing, Bethesda's writing consistently lets me down. So not a huge fan of 4 either. And I haven't played 76, so I can't really tell you about that, but I can happily say that I think the Fallout TV show is some of the best material in the franchise that's been put out.
Excellent.
So highly recommend that. And then, of course, as you know, two words, Helldivers 2.
Yeah.
2 doesn't count as a word. It's a number. So Helldivers 2. Really good.
Yeah, that game's consumed my time since it came out. So
yeah, I haven't... It's really bringing back for me some of like the old days of like, you know, just getting on Xbox Live with your friends after school and playing Halo or Call of Duty. Like, I'm kind of feeling that right now because literally everybody's playing it.
Yeah.
And while I will say, like, you know, it's toying with the aesthetics of fascism does leave me a little bit of unease.
Yeah,
because, you know, I do think that parody sometimes ends up accidentally glorifying the thing it intends to satirize.
That is, yeah, that happens.
I will say the game is just so damn fun that it worries me less when I'm playing it because I'm just having such a good time.
It's like people who don't understand Starship Troopers being a parody.
Yeah, you know, or people who watch The Boys and they think Homelander is like the coolest dude ever.
Yeah.
Or people who watch Dune and don't understand that Paul is actually not a good guy.
What?
I know, crazy. But anyway, also, I mean, Dune Part 2, I don't even know if we mentioned that last month, but so good.
Yeah, that was... I went and saw, I went and saw Godzilla vs. Kong, New Dynasty. So, and to all the people who are haters, they just need to hush. Like, it's so funny. Like, I loved it. I thought it was so much fun. The movie reminded me so much of like old Godzilla movies where it's just like, it's silly. It's fun. Like, you don't need commentary on nuclear war to have a Godzilla movie, which, I mean, don't get me wrong. -1 was amazing. And I was very happy that -1 won an Oscar, but yeah. You know, sometimes you need like that transporter or Fast and the Furious 10 to help just turn your brain off and just do something.
Right.
So
there's room for both.
Yeah, I think Godzilla has been around for 70 years and has basically transcended like media. Like, Godzilla can fit into all kinds of different areas. So
yeah, that's fair. We need a new Godzilla game. It's been a while since there's been a good one, I feel like.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he showed up in Call of Duty, him and Kong did.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I that doesn't count. That's
So.
But anyway.
I've just got finished reading a really good graphic novel, though. Shout outs to the fact that I listened to the Super Eye Patch Wolf, like Wooly versus Wolves thing, and he was talking about this book. And apparently it was a webcomic, and I finally was like, I broke down and bought it, and it's called Kill 6 Billion Demons.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very, like, the person that worked on this, the artwork, is just like, holy shit, amazing. And the world building itself is like incredibly fascinating. So I will definitely be probably picking up the second volume. And I've heard that there are more tidbits if you read the webcomic version as well. So that might be one of those like do both for me kind of situations.
Cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah, definitely. I've been in terms of like television and stuff. I watched the first two episodes of Kaiju Number 8. It was awesome. I am two episodes away from being done with King of the Hill. So that's kind of nice. Been like, that's been our thing, is just like, we're going to finish this. And it's one of those things where it's like, I didn't understand that show when I was younger, but now that I'm older, it's like, it makes so much sense to me and it's so much funnier. So.
Yeah, it's aged a lot better. I mean, like when I was younger, I associated it with other shows like The Simpsons and Family Guy and, you know, American Dad. And as a kid, I always thought it was like not as funny as these other shows.
Right.
But now looking back, I think Family Guy is stupid.
Yeah.
I think The Simpsons, some of the jokes land and some of them don't. But I find King of the Hill consistently hilarious.
Yeah, I throw King of the Hill. I would probably throw it in there with like how much I love Futurama. I've watched Futurama at least four times now.
Yeah.
Those guys really knew how to write some jokes.
So. Yeah, 100%.
But anyway, y'all aren't here to hear us, you know, fap on about King of the Hill and all those movies. You're here to hear us talk about video games, because that's what we like to do. So today, for our one-year anniversary episode, we decided we were going to talk about a game that I don't think at the time may have known its far-reaching impacts as its name, but nowadays you see it pretty much everywhere, and that is a game called Rogue. Came out in 1980. It was also known as Rogue, Exploring the Dungeons of Doom. It was designed by Michael Toy, Glenn Wickman, Ken Arnold, and John Lane. It was developed by AI Designs, and it was published by Epyx, E-P-Y-X, not like Epic now, in North America, and Masteronics in the EU. So funny enough, me and Michael actually played this game. We played for like, 2 hours on stream?
Yes, there is a bot up on our Twitch.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, you can also find it on, we're on YouTube as well. So it was an adventure for sure. Yes. So it was originally built for the Unix-based micro mini computer systems as a freely distributed execution. So basically it was freeware. And in Rogue, players control a character as they explore the Dungeons of Doom, searching for the Amulet of Yendor, located at the dungeon's lowest level. So throughout the game, you'll encounter a variety of monsters, each labeled by a letter A through Z, as also some numeric representations, as we found out that the letter 0 meant zombie. Along the way, players will find armor, weapons, potions, scrolls, wands, and each item has a completely random property until it's either investigated or used. Something else that we found out really fast. Like you opened a potion at one point and it did like one effect, and it'd be like,
right,
found an Azure potion, and you would drink it and a different effect.
It would be a different effect in between, like the effects would remain consistent for one playthrough. So if you found a black potion at the start of a playthrough and it, I don't know, cured your hunger or something, you could be certain that black potions, I believe, for the rest of the playthrough would do the same thing. But if you started a new playthrough and found a black potion, you would have to drink it again to see what new randomly generated effect it had been given.
And also something that was kind of neat was you could call your items whatever you wanted to after you discovered them. So I think you called your black potion yummers.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and scrolls would be like, you would pick them up and look at them in your inventory, and they would just be like randomized until you actually read them.
So, right, it would have like a gibberish name.
And Michael discovered how much putting on armor was a terrible idea.
Yes, I somehow managed to find cursed items back to back in multiple playthroughs.
Yeah.
A cursed armor, and then I think two cursed rings, I think, in the same playthrough.
Yeah, it was hilarious. So movement in the game was used during arrow keys, and you performed actions through a very large and screen-sized command list. Like, it was a lot. I still think the funniest thing about the command list was there was a supervisor mode.
Yes, I was going to mention that, yeah.
Yeah, so if your boss came up, you could like hit a button and it looks like you're just on a command prompt screen.
Yeah, it pulls up the fake like MS-DOS thing where it just, yeah.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
It was. Combat in the game is turn-based. So each action constitutes a turn. Moving near an enemy and puts you in their range. And it's not like how you would think of as like turn-based combat today of like in like an RPG or something where you take your turn, something happens. Turns are happening almost kind of in like real time. If you push a button, you take a turn. I think like, I believe you pushed like the rest key like 90 something times and then just died.
Yeah, well, I held it down and I didn't realize that it was going to like go turbo mode on me, because by holding the rest button, I accidentally rested like 30 times in quick succession. And that meant that I got charged and killed almost instantly by every single enemy that was nearby because I had wasted 30 turns.
Yeah, so when we say it's turn-based, it is in terms of like actual mechanics of how the game is operating. It is, in fact, turn-based. It just doesn't look like that to you.
It's almost like super hot, you know, where it's like the world moves around you in the same moment that you're moving, but it doesn't when you're not.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. And then, so players will have, you have one life to make it all the way to very bottom of the dungeon to find the amulet. And if you die, for variety of ways that you can die, because good Lord, there was a lot of ways to die in this game. You'd have to start over back at the beginning. And each game would be completely different from the previous map. Item placement, item description, enemy locations, all random. So it really, you know, did its best with the procedural generation stuff. So. Yeah.
My favorite ways that I died were to slimes, which it turns out can replicate almost infinitely if you get unlucky enough. I kept calling slimes the run-ender after that, because there was just a chance that if you fought a slime, it would just multiply until it killed you.
Yeah.
And then also we learned that you could die to hunger if you ignore eating long enough.
Yeah, there was there's a food mechanic in the game.
There is a food mechanic in the game.
So
that was fun. That was cool for science.
We discovered that, you know, ice monsters could shoot. And there were like hidden, you had to like, there was a point where it's like you couldn't progress any further. So you just have to like walk around the room, spamming the search key and hope you found a hidden door.
Right. But then I think your hunger went up, or your hunger increased every single turn that you spent. So you were kind of de-incentivized to just spam the search key if you didn't have something to look for, because pressing S to search would actually use a full turn.
Right.
It was, so I think if you were running around and just spamming S to search while you were walking everywhere, you would get hungry very quickly.
And the fun part to think about is the graphical interface for this game is just like, it's ASCII art. Like, it was like dashes and your character was a little yellow box, and you would encounter a letter, and that was an enemy. And each letter was a different type of enemy.
Yeah.
So
S, slime, I think, right? H, hobgoblin, O, orc.
Yeah. There was emus.
Yeah. In dungeons. Yeah. That was weird.
So, but anyway, like a fun little tidbit here of like, so the amulet was called the Amulet of Yendor. So Yendor was Rodney spelled backwards. And if you just press enter at the character naming screen, your default character's name was Rodney, because I think like you were like, who's Rodney? I'm like, that's you.
Yeah. I did that quite a few times, I think, where it ended up just calling me Rodney, and I was like, okay, fine.
Yeah. So Rogue was inspired by other text-based computer games, such as 1971's Star Trek and a personal favorite of the show, Colossal Cave Adventure from 1976, yes, along with the high fantasy setting of Dungeons & Dragons. So,
what's interesting about Rogue's, I suppose, aesthetic influences from a high fantasy genre is that none of this would really be that inferential from the game itself. In fact, if you wanted to get a lot of the story for Rogue, you actually had to have a copy of the instruction manual. Almost slightly off of the name of the podcast.
Just but slightly.
We do have an electronic version of it here, and actually there is a 3-page kind of a lore document introduction narration here that I'm actually going to read. So I can channel my dungeon master for a second here as I read this.
Go for it.
This is the quest for the amulet. How long has it been? How many lifetimes have passed since I began my sojourn through this maze of underground passageways, of damp, dimly lit chambers? How long have I been alone, the only human among a menacing crew of hideous subterranean beasts, stumbling over forlorn reminders that others have passed this way before me, never to return? Long before I forgot the warmth of the noonday sun or the refreshing coolness of the evening breeze, I forgot my name. Call me what you will, I am the Rogue. As I wander, I hold fast in my mind the one object that stands out from all the others, the sacred amulet of Yendor. This precious gift was left behind by magicians of old to remind mankind of its origins. Stolen by the evil dungeon lord, who despised its beauty and purity, the amulet has remained hidden in the deepest reaches of this torturous maze, calling those who seek it to sure destruction. Long ago, I began my quest for this object, this prize spoken of only in hushed tones by even the bravest knights and guildmasters around the dying embers of evening fires. Long ago, the magic amulet of Yendor began burning its way into my heart, began drawing me here to my uncertain fate. Somehow, I found my way to this place, rolled back the moss-covered stone, and entered its darkness. Now I abide here, searching endlessly for the precious amulet and finding a thousand horrors. Through these unlit corridors I wander, stumbling in the dark, encountering new ordeals at every turn. In one chamber, heat causes my suit of armor to burn the very skin it was designed to protect. In another, a chill penetrates to the bone, turning my limbs to ice. Everywhere, I am relentlessly pursued by beasts and demons. I cannot begin to count them. There are creatures of every low and mean quality lurking here. Formless slimes and equators, bats and goblins, centaurs, and that most hideous and unnatural of creatures, the Ur-Vile. Fortunately, my ever-ready mace serves to quickly dispatch many of my adversaries. Against other stronger beasts, I must defend myself with other weapons. Arrows, daggers, magic wands, or deadly potions. I stumble from battle to battle, taking care to rest occasionally or to partake in a few morsels of food. One gift the magicians make available to true seekers of the amulet, and to them alone is the gift of life after life. Yet even this gift is tainted with a curse by the Lord of the Dungeon, for each time I sleep, the sleep called death, I find myself carried unknowingly back to the very first room of the highest level of the dungeon, from whence I must again begin the torturous, unpredictable journey time and time again. Why does nothing now look familiar? Is this another of the Dungeon Lord's tricks, or is it my rapidly eroding memory that makes everything seem changed? I wake from the sleep called death to find that nothing is the same. Everything is transformed, familiar, yet treacherously rearranged. As I plumb the uncharted depths of this Dungeon of Doom, I wonder, where am I? Is this a passageway I've trudged before? Is this the chamber in which I left my cloak of chainmail? Does this wall conceal a trapdoor I found and lost lifetimes ago? On my way, I must acquire the provisions that make themselves available to me, despite the fact that they were left behind by the miserable victims of this place. Here a bit of food, and there a suit of armor from an unfortunate owner. quivers of arrows for my sturdy shortbow. Oh yes, and magic wands, enchanted staffs, and potent elixirs, some powerfully good, some horribly evil. Manuscripts of ancient texts, meaningless to my eyes, which vanish into thin air before I can understand them. And of course, gold, a king's ransom of it, yet useless unless I somehow make my way to the very bottom of the dungeon and back again. As I collect these objects and put them in my knapsack, I must discard others, or use them at once to fend off the adversaries that dog my every step. Still, even my few possessions are affected by the Dungeon Lord's spells. Potions which in lifetimes past revitalized me now send me sprawling on the floor, clutched in spasms, burning with fever. Armor which served me in battle after battle becomes a crushing burden, cursed by the Dungeon Lord. Each time I attempt to plumb these depths, I must be constantly attentive. Should my guard slip for a moment, I will fall prey to the horrors that surround me. In my mind, shining like a beacon in the darkness, the amulet of Yendor beckons me on, deeper and deeper. One day I shall hold it in my hand, caress it in the void, then race level by level back to the surface. There I shall hold it high, deliver it once again to the light of day, and reclaim again the name so long ago forgotten. And that is the game's story.
That man is going hollow, and you can't tell me otherwise.
Right. No, I mean, it's, yeah, I was going to mention Dark Souls at some point, because I do find it interesting that Rogue, very much like modern gamers perhaps recognize Dark Souls for, finds a, like, diegetic, lore-friendly way to explain respawning and restarting.
Yeah, this dude's curse. It's funny, too, that, like, when you were reading that, I actually hadn't read all the way through it, and so, like, This is my first time hearing all of it. It reminds me of when we were playing through the game, you were like, what do I do with all this gold? And now we know. Yeah. I was like, yeah. Oh, it's just a high score function. I'm like, no, now it actually has, like, context.
Right. Even though it is a lore document, it helpfully kind of explains some of the game mechanics in lore-friendly ways. Like, yeah, gold, totally useless. I think we're so conditioned, especially by modern roguelikes, you know, that you find gold and there's going to be a shop somewhere and you can spend it on stuff.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
This is just, yeah, how to check high score. Also, you know, the mention that every single time, you know, you restart similar potions, right? Potions which in lifetimes past revitalized me now send me sprawling on the floor, clutched in spasms, burning with fever. To mention how early we were talking about how the potions can actually change effects from playthrough to playthrough.
Right.
It's a very interesting way to try and relay game mechanics that is committed to the aesthetic of the game's story, which I find very cool.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of interesting. And for anybody listening, and if you're ever curious, like, there are many of ways apparently out there to play Rogue online. We purchased it through Steam. There's like a $4 version, I think is how much it wound up costing.
Something like that.
And even if you don't have any intention of just really diving into it, like, just going and watching us play it or just trying it for yourself is, I mean, it's an experience. I mean, granted, it's not the most graphically interesting game.
No.
But it definitely gets the gears in your brain turning. I can see why this game was very addictive.
Right, especially in the 80s, you know, if your choice is this or, I don't know, Pong.
Or like,
right.
Or going, or like spending money at the arcade, and you had this freeware game that was just available on an open network at a university. So,
yeah.
Like, I see why this could catch fire. I guess, like, going a little bit more into it, it's, you know, the creator, one of the creators, Michael Toy, you know, he began his work on Rogue after getting to play 1971 Star Trek at his father's workplace mainframe. His dad was a nuclear scientist who apparently they got access to bring your family to work once a day. And they had a mainframe computer that had this 71 Star Trek on it. And he was really interested in the ideas of how it represented combat through characters on screen and requiring players to make strategic decisions. This has inspired him to want to recreate the game on other systems. He eventually enrolled into the University of California, Santa Cruz in the late 1970s and would start work on the PDP-11 and the VAX-11, which were like earlier computers. And after looking on the ARPANET, which we had previously mentioned in Mainframe Gaming, for what was out there, he came upon William Couthers and Don Wood's game Colossal Cave Adventure. So
I think it's funny how a couple of names that consistently show up in the history of video games as just being like influences. I mean, we see a lot of Tolkien, we see a lot of Star Trek, and we see a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. Like, consistently, it's just those three.
Yeah.
Because, like, Empire was also, right? I mean, the whole thing was you played as Klingons, Federation. I just think it's cool.
Yeah, and then, you know, Colossal Cave Adventure always tends to pop up a lot, too.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, like, a wide overview of, like, Rogue as the game. And, you know, and this game eventually kind of turns into more. And it had a lot of, you know, amazing influences. Like I said, even for us playing it, like, knowing context and going and putting yourself in the shoes of someone on a personal computer back in the 1980s, I see where this game, you know, in between, like, working on something, someone probably, like, fired up Rogue. And I guess it was kind of like how we were talking about, like, during playing it, where it's like we both went in blind playing this game. And it was even better because we were able to talk to one another while we were playing it to kind of, like, relay information. And, you know, you think, like, somebody probably, like, played it, went and told their friends played it, and then suddenly they all start comparing notes. And you just imagine, like, some of the argument discrepancies about, like, the randomness of items. Like, no, the aquamarine potion does this.
Right. Or, like, dude, I ran into a dragon yesterday. It's like, somebody might say, dude, you're lying, that doesn't exist in the game, I haven't seen it yet. I mean, like, before the internet, you know, it's like, how would you ever know these things? Like, you couldn't fact check them.
Yeah, and I think we even talked about in the episode, like, when we were streaming it, like, people were probably, like, writing down, like, just large amounts of notes to remember, like, things in this game. And it also had levels, like, it had a level up system as you, like, progressed too, so.
Yeah, that's true.
So eventually Rogue, as it would, like, kind of chart its course through the 80s, it may not been the game that I started the idea of randomized elements, because obviously, like, Colossal Cave Adventure's earlier games also did that, but it was one of the most popular ones due to its accessibility, as well as it was just a really simple design. These design elements would go on to influence tons of games throughout history, and its effects are still felt even today. Like, you see it a lot.
Yes. If you've ever heard the term roguelike or roguelite, you now know the rogue that game is like, or light or whatever.
Yeah, the second one's always weird.
Yeah, this is the rogue in question. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, because similarly, right, when you hear the term souls-like these days, it's, you know that it's referring to Dark Souls. So this is the Dark Souls of roguelikes or something. I know that's the term, the Dark Souls of whatever, but
I still feel like Rogue is the Souls of the Souls game now.
Yeah.
The OG Souls game.
Dark Souls is the Rogue of Souls likes. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's all Rogue.
Yeah, it's all Rogue all the way down.
Yeah.
So interestingly, now that we're going to kind of talk a little bit about roguelikes, it's worth mentioning that, and this is kind of, you know, I was interested when we were doing research for this, and I was just looking at first at the Wikipedia on roguelikes as a genre, because it seems like there's some contention as to what actually belongs in the genre.
Right.
There are, according to some, examples of roguelikes that actually predate Rogue, and I guess you could debate whether or not these technically count as being part of the genre. I mean, it almost seems to defeat the purpose of calling them a roguelike if these games actually came first.
Yeah, it's just like, retroactively, you can't really place something like that.
Right. Well, it's kind of like, you know, the fact that Colossal Cave, not Colossal Cave Adventure, but Adventure, you know, goes down in history as being the Easter egg game, even though it's not the first. So it's like, we're stuck with the term roguelike for better or worse at this point. But there are design similarities that predate Rogue. In examples of games, actually, that we've talked about on the podcast before, if you listened to our episode on Mainframe Gaming with the Play-Doh 4 computer, You've probably heard us talk about games like Pettit 5, D&D, not D&D, but D&D, and Moria. The games are from 1975, 1975, and then 1978, respectively, which puts them actually a couple of years before Rogue. Though it is worth mentioning that there is no evidence of influence between these games, we have no way of knowing if the people who made Rogue were playing these Plato games. In fact, it's probably unlikely, given the fact that the Plato games did not have that much reach. But who knows? It's impossible to say.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it would probably require us to do a little research, and in fact, might even require us to do a future episode about it. But it would be interesting to see where the connective tissue for Colossal Cave Adventure is, because at this point, I'm fairly certain Colossal Cave Adventure is probably going to be like a throwback to a lot of stuff we're looking into. So it'd be interesting to see if the creators of that game played Pettit 5, D&D, and Moria.
Yeah, certainly. So moving forward with kind of understanding, I guess, what a roguelike is, or what some people might think a roguelike is, I want to kind of point us in a direction that one of our friends, Casey, who is also, I think, a listener of the podcast and somebody that we play video games with, mentioned when we were streaming Rogue, that there was this thing called the Berlin Convention, or rather the Berlin Interpretation, that was created at the International Roguelike Development Conference in 2008. This was kind of one of the earlier attempts of game developers to put a hard and fast definition down for what constitutes a game that's actually a roguelike. And I can read off some of the description here. This comes from roguebasin.com. I think it's a wiki that exists for all things concerning rogue and roguelikes. General principles, and I'll read this off directly. Roguelike refers to a genre, not merely like rogue. This genre is represented by its canon. The canon for roguelikes is Ancient Domains of Mystery, Angband, Crawl, NetHack, and Rogue. And we'll be talking about each of these very briefly in a second here. This list can be used to determine how roguelike a game is. Missing some points does not mean the game is not a roguelike. Likewise, possessing some points does not mean the game is a roguelike. The reference to points here is actually an interesting thing. Basically, these definitions are not used to fully exclude or include a game into the genre of roguelike. Actually, what it's meant to do is kind of say, this game possesses, you know, maybe 5 out of the 6 elements that we would normally say roguelikes have. And so therefore, is it a roguelike? It's maybe 5/6 of a roguelike.
Yeah, it's kind of like a DNA test, but for rogue games.
Right. The purpose of the definition is for the roguelike community to better understand what the community is studying. It is not to place constraints on developers or games. And so there are high value factors. These are important factors for a game to be considered a roguelike, and I'll just read the titles of each of these briefly. That is random environment generation, permadeath, turn-based, grid-based, non-modal, complexity, resource management, hack and slash, which also means something very different today.
Yeah.
Exploration and discovery. And then there are low value factors. Single player character. Monsters are similar to players, which I can explain that one. It says rules that apply to the player apply to monsters as well. They have inventories, equipment, use items, cast spells, etc. Tactical challenge, ASCII display, ASCII, and dungeons and numbers. So I guess you need to see explicitly the numbers that are being represented when they occur.
Which I would say when we played Rogue, it never told us how much damage we were doing to enemies.
Well, it would show up, I think, or no, you're right. It would say like,
oh, it's like
this being very hard, right, or something like that.
It never explicit. Like you can tell how much health you were losing, but it would never tell you how much damage you were doing to the enemy. You could kind of understand based on like whatever your weapon was. There was like a stats page where you could see like what your weapons were and such. Yeah. But
But then there were critical hits, which you wouldn't then know unless there's a fixed modifier for critical hits, in which case you could infer it, I suppose.
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about, like, there are stuff in Rogue that probably, like, majorly fits into these conventions, but maybe sometimes not. So, yeah. Like, I definitely would think that, like, like, there was the one that you said, oh, the monsters being similar to players, which, like, no.
Right, yeah, it's like, so many of these examples, and we'll get to it in a second, because there's a blog post that I want to talk about called Screw the Berlin Interpretation. But it's crazy to me, because reading through these, like, there are so many games that I would consider, at least by modern standards, to be a roguelike that do not satisfy many of these.
Right.
But we can talk about that in a second. I do want to talk briefly about some of these canon games, right? So according to the Berlin Interpretation, what are these canon games? The earliest is a game called Hack, and later NetHack. And by the way, most of this information is just cursory stuff that you can find on the Wikipedia, just in case you're wondering where we got it. NetHack, similar to Rogue. Turn-based, grid-based, hack-and-slash dungeon-crawling gameplay, procedurally generated dungeons and treasure and permadeath, requiring the player to restart the game anew should the player character die. It uses ASCII graphics. One of the main differences between Hack and Rogue is that Hack actually had players more clearly define their characters. You chose your character's race, role, sex, and alignment, and then actually there are roles that you can pick, or like classes, like knight, wizard, rogue, and priest. And then also archaeologist, tourist, and caveman.
I'm gonna play a caveman.
Right. It reminds me of, like, what is it? In Dark Souls, there's always that one option that's, like, the worst, where you're just a guy.
Like the wretch or something?
Yeah, it's something like that. Wretched, maybe.
You're always, I'm like, forgetting. Level one, and all your stats are as low as possible.
Yeah. Hack later got turned into NetHack, first released in 1987 and then maintained. I think it is ongoing still.
Yeah, there's like a massive Wikipedia for NetHack. And in fact, NetHack even has a entry on its Wikipedia for Rogue that goes in more detail than other stuff that I was able to find.
Yeah. Well, shout out to the NetHack community, if it's still alive.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I just want to say NetHack also involves recovering the Amulet of Yendor. So there's, you know, maybe a little bit of plagiarism going on here. I'm not sure. But that's funny to me. Beyond Hack, another game that is actually kind of a game we've talked about before, I think, which is Moria. Moria later turned into another game called Angband, because if you're remembering, the Berlin interpretation specifically mentions Angband. Moria is another roguelike game from 1983. It has ASCII graphics, and it is kind of a version of the 1978 Moria, which we talked about briefly when talking about the Play-Doh mainframe games. Similar to Hack and Rogue, more similar perhaps to Hack in the sense that you do get to choose your race: human, half-elf, elf, halfling, gnome, dwarf, half-orc, or half-troll. And then you get to pick your class from warrior, mage, priest, rogue, ranger, or paladin.
Yeah.
And there's a shop in Moria, unlike Rogue. So you actually do get to spend your gold on stuff, which is pretty cool.
Thank God.
After Moria, specifically, and then Angband in 90, I'll just say that now, 93 is basically an updated version, or derived from Moria. The name also, Angband, is the Fortress of Morgoth in the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien, which I mentioned earlier in the episode that Tolkien kind of shows up all over the place in influencing both Dungeons and Dragons and early role-playing games. Similar to Moria, you know, you pick your race, you pick your class. You can go to a town. The player actually begins in a town where they can buy equipment before beginning the descent. So interestingly, Angband actually kind of gives you a little bit more control over the, I guess, starting situation of your runs, because you can actually kind of make, like, maybe you decide you'd like to buy one item all the time.
Yeah.
You'll always have it. So that's pretty cool. You can already kind of see in the early history of the roguelike genre that already we're moving in a direction that maybe limits randomness and more towards allowing players to more, I don't know, standardize their play styles and their playthroughs in a certain way.
And it's still using some of the facets that we know. Like, there are still randomness in it, but it's like, it's almost like it's curbing them. It's curbing back the more unforgiving randomness parts back.
Right. Okay. I mean, according to the Berlin interpretation, it's just random environment generation that's required. So,
gotcha.
Technically, so, and this is word for word what the Berlin interpretation says, the game world is randomly generated in a way that increases replayability. Appearance and placement of items is random. Appearance of monsters is fixed. Or rather, appearance of monsters is fixed, yes. Their placement is random.
Gotcha.
And then fixed content, plots, or puzzles, or vaults removes randomness. Though, you know, even Rogue has fixed things, right? Presumably the Amulet of Yendor is down there somewhere.
And it's always fixed. Yeah, it's always on the bottom floor, but, you know, right, its position may always be changed.
Beyond Angband, there's Ancient Domains of Mystery, a roguelike video game designed and developed by Thomas Biskup and released in 1994. Similar story. Ancient Domains of Mystery presents an initial choice of male or female player character from 12 races and then 22 classes. I'm not going to name them all out here. But this game actually allows you to explore a ton of areas and complete different quests. And it actually has a alignment system of lawful, neutral, or chaotic, which is pretty cool. That affects NPC and deity interaction with the character. Huh, so you can kind of see it how, yeah, as time goes on, these games start to get a little bit more complex in terms of the systems that are at play.
Sounds kind of like World Tendency and like Demon's Soul, or was the game was called Black and White, or like,
oh, yeah,
or like Fable.
Yeah. I love Black. It's like a core memory unlocked. Anyway, and then Crawl is a game that I had to research a little bit more that gets mentioned in the Berlin interpretation, because actually Crawl, or rather its longer name is Linley's Dungeon Crawl, this game doesn't even have a Wikipedia entry. I found a kind of a wiki entry from on roguebasin.com, which is the same website that has the Berlin interpretation transcript. This game was published in 97, and, you know, very similar, kind of same song and dance as many of the other games. You have a character race. You can get mutations, which I think, like, will often affect your character and how they change. Apparently, this game is less concerned with classes affecting how your character functions and more concerned actually with just using race. Lots of gods, and it gets rid of, this game is known, I think, for being very unforgiving and difficult. This particular wiki entry mentions that there is save scumming that's kind of possible in other games. So it says very little room for scumming. Normally, there is nothing like NetHack's Nurse Dancing or Adom's Stone Giant scumming. I don't know what these things mean because I haven't played these games. Presumably, you know, players found ways to break the game.
Right.
It is not possible to stay in a region of moderate difficulty indefinitely like one can in bands when engaged in stat gain. Again, these words, I mean, this is a foreign language to me. But it sounds like this game was far more punishing than some of the earlier examples of roguelikes.
Reading ancient text.
Yeah. And then Linley's Dungeon Crawl was later adapted, or rather there was a community developed successor to Linley's Dungeon Crawl called Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, which came in 2006.
Yeah, that was the one I had a coworker that told me about, that apparently it's still being played today. So,
yeah. And so these are kind of the games that the Berlin interpretation points to as saying, here is an example of what roguelikes are. Now, knowing, you know, if you've listened to the podcast before at all, you know that I am allergic to hard and fast category lines. I tend to have issues with definitions that like to be all or nothing. And so I do appreciate that this Berlin interpretation allows itself to be a little bit more fluid as far as what gets to count as a roguelike and what is not. However, I do want to produce perhaps a counter argument here. The Rogue Basin wiki actually mentions that there is a blog post, or an article rather, by a man named Darren Gray, who, well, it's called Screw the Berlin Interpretation.
Yeah, he comes out pretty hard.
He does. And I want to read like two of the paragraphs that he has written here. You can find this, I think, on his blog, gamesofgray.com. Games of Gray. And he writes, "The problem with the Berlin interpretation is a problem of definitions in general. Firstly, a definition is only as good as its use in general conversation. The terms decimate and role-playing game no longer hold their literal meaning, and neither does roguelike. Meanings and context change over time, and in the 5 years since the interpretation was written, there have been many changes in the roguelike scene, with novel 7DRLs and indie roguelikes stretching the genre into new and unforeseen areas. It's out of date and out of touch with modern roguelikes. All definitions are doomed to end up like this. Those who insist on sticking to the rules are annoying grammar pedants who spend more time arguing about English than having real social conversations. By analogy, those who argue over the Berlin interpretation aren't playing enough modern roguelikes. Secondly, definitions are about excluding things. They ultimately draw a line in the sand and say, if you stray beyond, you are forgotten. This is terrible from a design point of view, as it limits creative potential. It's awful from a community point of view because it pushes people out. The Berlin interpretation tried to be wishy-washy with its you don't need every rule, but people don't read it like that. Descriptors like turn-based get used as clubs to beat other games out, even games that do innovative things with the time system like Faster Than Light."
Wow.
Which Faster Than Light, a really good example of a modern roguelike, I think, in my opinion, certainly. And I will say this is a conversation that is perhaps near and dear to me, because in working on my dissertation, one of the things that I've been talking about with my advisors is, like, you know, the question of how to even identify what a video game is in the first place.
Right.
Because, like, some people would have definitions that exclude more story-based things, you know, like walking simulators, like, you know, Dear Esther or something like that. And I'm inclined to maybe agree with Mr. Gray here that a video game is that thing that individuals call a video game. Which is to say, video games are whatever the community decides video games are.
Right.
And if the community of video games and video gamers collectively decides that, you know, Dear Esther and Everyone's Gone Home to the Rapture, or whatever that game is called, are video games, then I agree that they're video games.
Yeah.
And so if everyone these days uncontroversially recognizes that games like Faster Than Light, for instance, are examples of the roguelike genre, then I personally have no interest in debating that. In fact, I'm totally fine saying, fine, you know, it is a roguelike because that is the word that people use to recognize this game's inclusion in the genre.
It's kind of like what you were going over with, like definitions, where, like, even reading the Berlin interpretation, you mentioned the words hack and slash. Like, in 2008, right, hack and slash probably meant something completely different than what we think today of as hack and slash. It's like,
right.
That's kind of a genre I don't hear much about anymore.
Nope. It's not a popular, I mean, like, there aren't many hack and slash games, I feel like, being released these days compared to, like, the early or late 2000s.
I almost feel like you could probably say, like, something like Dynasty Warriors or something like that would fit that genre. Yeah. But it's like, you know, it's an outdated term at this point. It's like,
right,
kind of come about.
Hack and slash. What's funny to me, too, is that turn-based and hack and slash, in my mind, are almost mutually exclusive terms.
Yeah.
Because when I think turn-based, I think, like, I don't know, Fire Emblem, you know, or Final Fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Like XCOM or something like that.
Yeah. And then hack and slash is like Devil May Cry, Bayonetta.
Yeah, but see, even the, even to this point, those games have kind of become character action games now.
Right.
They may have hack and slash elements.
Right. So I suppose moving beyond, you know, kind of these attempts to even define explicitly what a roguelike is or what the roguelike genre is or ought to be, it might be useful maybe for us and for the viewers, or not the viewers, the listeners, if we talk about maybe just some of what our favorite examples of roguelikes as we understand them to be are.
Yeah, and in fact, we took the time to do it all of last week. Me and Michael took turns streaming on the instruction booklet Twitch channel to play some roguelikes and roguelites. Yeah. I played Crypt of the NecroDancer and Enter the Gungeon, and you played Noita.
I played Noita for the first time, actually, too, which is a very fun game. And, you know, I mean, if people are interested after this episode comes out, we could always do more because that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and we plan on, you know, exploring more. I'm actually going to find me a capture card so I can plug my Switch up for a future episode that may prove to be, you know, important as well, about a company called Nintendo.
I don't think I've heard of them.
Yeah.
But I'll be interested to research, you know.
Yeah, I heard they make playing cards.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Enter the Gungeon and Crypt of the NecroDancer.
So I think I talked about this when I was like, so you got to come in and watch while I was playing Crypt of the NecroDancer, and how I mentioned that, like, Crypt of the NecroDancer felt more like playing original Rogue after having played Rogue, where it's like you move when you're when the enemies move, except for, you know, Crypt of the NecroDancer has a nice little fun caveat of it's a rhythm game as well. So, you know, and that's something I think that's like indicative of like modern games. It's like merging genres together is always like a fun experiment. And, you know, Crypt of the NecroDancer also maintained random generalization. All the items were randomized. But it, you know, it did some more modern stuff. I could skip ahead levels if I unlocked them. I could also gain permanent upgrades that allowed me to move forward. You know, there's characters, multiple characters that do different things. So it's, you know, it has that DNA of Rogue and some of these other predecessor games, but yet allows itself to be something of its own.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even watching it, I could definitely see the bones of Rogue, you know, moving up and down the dungeon with the grid tile set. But with just that funny gimmick of, you know, you have to move in step with the music.
Yeah. So it kind of, and in, you know, that difficulty is still there. The game still has permadeath. So, and then on the flip side, I have something like Enter the Gungeon, which isn't so much as turn-based as it's more like moving around and reactionary. And it's still a roguelike because there are tons of randomized elements, but it's, what if we took this genre of Rogue and merged it with a bullet hell? So now you're taking your quick and your twitchy response times of like a bullet hell and combining it with like, okay, I need to make sure I find the right kind of guns. You know, everything's going to be randomized. How do I make the best out of the situation that's being put in front of me? So, you know, random enemies, and then there are like tons of secrets, but it also has some of the more of the modern, you know, amenities where I can unlock more guns and unlock skips to earlier, faster levels. I still have permadeath, and there are in fact, to even add to this, there are elements that make the game even harder because you can make it even more randomized, and it also has multiple characters. So, you know, again, where it's like you see these bones and this like framing structure of Rogue, and then someone's taking that and then fitting it into something new.
Yeah, which I think is cool. Whether or not, you know, the Berlin interpretation folks think that means it's not a roguelike, who cares at the end of the day is my response, perhaps.
So what were your thoughts on playing Noita?
Yeah, so Noita, and I deeply actually want to continue playing Noita, though I also want to stream it again because of that streamer integration mode, which was very cool.
Yeah.
Noita, for the listeners, and you can watch the VOD, or you could even go on YouTube and just watch any other. There's some pretty good videos on Noita. An incredibly random Finnish roguelike where you play as a wizard. You spawn into the top level of a dungeon right outside of it,
you're given two magic wands with random spells assigned to it. And from there, you kind of just have to go downwards, presumably to get some kind of ancient treasure. I have no idea. I don't know if the Amulet of Yandor is down there or something. But randomly generated levels in the dungeon where every single tile or every single like pixel on screen is generated in an interesting way that allows for a lot of terrain destruction. If you drop a bomb, for instance, it will just destroy a whole chunk of the ground or wall next to where you drop it, which makes for some very interesting gameplay where you can path through the dungeon in ways that take advantage of the destructive capabilities of whatever wands or spells you may have gotten lucky enough to get at the start of the game. Incredibly unforgiving, and you know, like there's a lot of weird shenanigans that seem to occur. I mean, I got killed by that giant jellyfish boss, which I only found one time in 2 hours and then couldn't find again. I think perhaps my favorite part of that whole experience was accidentally discovering when I started the game that there was a Twitch integration streamer mode where I could put the name of the channel into the game, and that would actually pull a voting system up on screen that, like, every 2 minutes it would ask Twitch viewers to vote on a random effect to happen in game that I would have to adjust to.
Worm rain. So,
yeah. Worm rain, treasure, you know, pile, friendly ghosts, enemy ghosts.
Like delete the floor.
yeah. Delete terrain, which would just delete a giant section of the dungeon around me. The worm boss that I think Adam spawned in at one point, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That ended up killing me. It was just very fun. And I think that I honestly now feel like I would almost be missing something if I tried to play the game without the stream. Because right. The stream added that extra layer of interactivity that made it very exciting to not only play, but exciting to stream, because I felt like there was a way that it was including my viewers in a way that a lot of games don't do. So yeah. I definitely want to do that again, because I really enjoyed that. And I would be remiss if I overlooked an opportunity to bring up what has perhaps been one of my favorite games that I've played in recent memory, which is a little game by the name of Fear and Hunger.
Gasp!
Now, Fear and Hunger is definitely one of these games where I think that, you know, depending on how much of a stickler you want to be about definitions, may or may not be a roguelike. Suffice it to say that according to the description on Steam, this game is a hybrid of survival horror and dungeon crawler genres, with its influence ranging from Silent Hill to NetHack. There are roguelike elements to the game, as well as a heavy foundation of a JRPG. Fear and Hunger is heavy on atmosphere and ruthless in its difficulty.
And
I may stream Fear and Hunger, but I will need to find a mod that makes it stream friendly, because there are many things that happen in the game that Twitch will not be happy about.
Yeah, there's some definite content warnings to throw up if folks want to look into this game.
Yes, for 100%. That being said, I mean, just an immaculately crafted game from a design perspective and an aesthetic perspective in my mind. And it does have roguelike elements because, and this is especially true for Fear and Hunger 1, less so for Fear and Hunger 2, though it still has some random elements to it. Fear and Hunger 1, the map is not randomly generated, but there are different layouts that can get chosen from randomly every single time you start the game. So you're outside the dungeon, you decide to walk in the main door, you have the first level of the dungeon, and I believe that there are three possible layouts that this first level of the dungeon can have. And normally upon walking into the dungeon, you'll immediately recognize, okay, I've got layout A, I've got layout B, or I've got layout C. On top of that, there are variations in enemy spawns. So for instance, you can say, okay, I've got layout C. That means the guards in the dungeon can either be in this spot or they could be in this spot.
Right.
So there is some level of fixity, but there's also randomness within the fixity that's maybe less random than something like Rogue, but it definitely still creates a replayability element to it, where every single time you play, you're not quite sure what to expect.
Yeah.
Where the game goes fully off the rails in terms of how random it can be and how this can affect the trajectory of a playthrough is item spawns. Whenever you go around to loot the map, for instance, there are barrels and crates that you can look around and find random pieces of loot. And then, depending on the layouts you get, the dungeon, especially the first two or three levels, will have libraries that you can go check the bookshelves. There are specific bookshelves that have a chance, if you win a 50-50 coin flip, to give you an exceptionally rare item from a list of items that you can get that can affect your gameplay. So you might find the Necronomicon, and you decide to read the Necronomicon, and you have to make a 50-50 coin flip to either die instantly or to get a new, very powerful spell or something like that. You can get insanely lucky and find something called an empty scroll, which allows you to basically inscribe an incantation into the scroll based on if you know the code, and basically grant yourself almost any item or any spell in the game that you want immediately. And so one of the funniest things about playing this game, especially if you're a streamer, and there are people who like to stream this game, for Polo on YouTube is somebody who's really kind of made a name for himself as a figure in the community. Super Eyepatch Wolf has done a couple of videos on Fear and Hunger.
Yep.
There is a randomness to it where sometimes you'll start a new playthrough. You'll say like, okay, what do we got? Do we need to reset or do we go with this one? You run straight into the library, you check it, you get two empty scrolls. You're like, holy shit, this is the god playthrough, because now I can give myself end game items and I can trivialize and sequence break the game in a way that you might recognize in something like the original Dark Souls. Even though the original Dark Souls, there's no randomness to it. You just know how to break the game.
Yeah, one of the things of Dark Souls is learning the game.
Right. And then similar to Fear and Hunger, or rather similar to Rogue, Fear and Hunger has these elements of like, you know, you can die to hunger, you can die to going insane. I don't know if that's a thing that can happen. You can get sick. In fact, Fear and Hunger, one of the most devious things about the game is that randomly, depending on the layouts that you get, there will be these boards that have rusty nails poking out of them, like at various points in the dungeon. And if you step on one, you will instantly lose one HP and have an infection. And if you do not cure the infection, you will just die. So you have to find medicine to cure the infection, which is something, you know, like in Rogue, I remember there were certain things that you would do that would make you sick, and then you would have to find potions that made you feel better.
Yeah.
So I have to imagine that maybe you could die to sickness in Rogue as well, though it never happened to me.
Say you could die of starvation and Fear and Hunger or Rogue.
Exactly. You can die of Fear and Hunger and Fear and Hunger or Rogue.
Yeah. I guess another one that I would think of that's like modern, we brought it up already, which, you know, there was FTL, which is Faster Than Light. That game is awesome. And its rogue elements are your encounters are always different every time. There's also the one that kind of kicks off the modern era. There was Spelunky, which is a side scrolling 2D game where you play like kind of like an archaeologist. I've never actually played Spelunky. I've watched people play Spelunky. And then the one that I know of, like, I played of for a hot minute, but it didn't jive with me, which is, like, The Binding of Isaac. Another popular one that I can think of that I've played and put way too many hours into and even have it on my phone is Slay the Spire, which is a deck build and, you know, randomized elements plus incredibly hard gameplay with permadeath seems kind of good for a card game genre, you know. And then I think I have it listed here as the one that's probably the most famous roguelike that's out there is Hades.
Yes, definitely recently.
Yeah. Hades really took the roguelike genre and was like, what if we just put story into it and like made this really pretty game? I guess kind of like brings me to like our like final kind of point where like kind of the reason why I wanted to like look into this game, because it was in my mind a lot, was just like, you know, these elements of like rogue that existed, you know, way back in the 80s and we see nowadays, they create addictive gameplay. Like you know, I talk about Slay the Spire. I'm fairly certain, like right now, let's see. I can tell you for a matter of fact, I have put 333 hours into.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, you know, that's like, you know, and I think we talked about this previously at some point with like indie developers, where it's like these simple formulas and like simple templates of Rogue work really well in an indie environment. I think back a lot to and at a game developers conference at like GDC one year, Ocean Twin, the guys who created another successful roguelike called Dead Cells that I have played a lot, mentioned that Dead Cells was their last game that they had money to put into. Like they threw a Hail Mary hoping the game would take off. And it did. That game has made them gangbusters. Like,
yeah,
it has spawned so many expansions. They even did a crossover with Castlevania. Like,
yeah, very cool.
You know, it really, like, you know, taking Rogue elements and applying them to a 2D game with a really unique art style, and how you found your story, you know, through progressing through the game and dying multiple times, saved that company. But what I'm trying to get to is how it's interesting to me that these elements of Rogue have started to bleed into larger AAA games now. Yeah. Purposes of getting your players addicted. You know, keeping them playing the same game over and over again.
Right. Games as a service games. You know, like, I think what comes to mind for me is something like the new Suicide Squad game, for instance.
Yeah.
Where it's like, there can be something charming about, you know, computer-generated randomness that allows everything to be unique, and so that you can replay it, and that every single time it feels like a new thing. In fact, Helldivers 2, game both of us have been enjoying tremendously, is maybe a good example of this. Every single time we drop for a new mission, it genuinely feels like I'm on a new map. Like, I don't ever feel like I'm on the same map that I've been on. Maybe some of the smaller ones, like an extermination mission, but...
Right.
You know, that's kind of a rogue-ish element, I would say. You know, I certainly wouldn't call Suicide Squad or Helldivers a roguelike, but these are games that are kind of employing the same principles, so that every single time you play through something, it feels like it's new. But kind of as you suggest, you know, maybe the difference between something like Suicide Squad and Helldivers is that a game like Suicide Squad, you know, is doing that because it's trying to keep the players around longer to spend more money, and it's passing off, you know, this randomly generated or, you know, like mostly repetitive, slightly different content as, I don't know, like worth the full price tag somehow.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think about, you know, like thinking about like in some of the elements is like, and I think it's even mentioned in like some of the listings of roguelikes and the Wikipedia, where it talks about like Diablo.
Yeah,
the first two Diablo games, Diablo 2 was a game I played really early, you know, from like my high school days into college. Like, I loved that game. That game was like, you know, a lot of fun. And it, granted, it didn't have permadeath in that way. You could create permadeath through like playing a hardcore character, but the randomness of the map was always different. There were randomized enemy placement. Now, granted, there would be some enemies that were specifically here and find certain story beats in certain places. Your items were always randomized. So it always created like, you know, that sense of like that, like, oh man, this is really fun. Like, it kept you coming back. Then watch just like the trajectory of how that game genre has changed from like all of the horrible crap that happened with Diablo 3 and the real player auction house to the mobile version of Diablo Immortal, just trying to be a cash grab of like keeping players addicted to a game that they play over to Diablo 4. Like, you know, that game kind of like makes me think about like, where here's a game that has taken rogue elements, who I wouldn't call Diablo a rogue like or a rogue light. It uses elements, no. of the randomness to create that. And that's kind of how like playing Rogue felt, was like, oh man, this like combination of elements creates an addictive gameplay loop that is like enjoyable. So, and like, you know, I mentioned like, you know, like Hades being a game that's like has gotten like tons of praise and tons of acclaim, and Supergiant Games just gave it, you know, they, you paid like what, like almost like a $35, almost like $40 game.
It was like a $30 game, I think. Right, yeah. Now, $25.
Yeah, and like it was an indie game, and did it win Game of the Year?
It did, yeah.
Yeah, like, and then even to more thoughts of like, think about, there was a game that came out. I think he played it. Is it Returnal?
Yes, Returnal. Very good.
Yeah, like that's a roguelike game. You know, you're doing 100%. The loops. But it's like, it was really pretty. I didn't
it's
really
definitely not ASCII. It's not turn-based. It's not hack and slash.
So, you know, and it's interesting to me to think about, and like, I think it's like we've had this discussion before. Like, genre gets real nebulous.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, yeah, the joke of earlier of it's rogue all the way down. Like, I think it's interesting that like more AAA games and like larger companies are looking at roguelike genre that was like really helping pioneer the indie scene in like the mid 2000s, like the 2010s. And they're starting to take those elements, and some in some facets, they're using them in very like smart and wise decision, like design choice ways. Versus there's a very terrible underside to it as well.
Yeah, I think so. Also, Vampire Survivors.
Ah, yeah, Vampire Survivors.
That game is great, and it's $5, and all of the DLC is like $2. I mean, it's like so, and they made a mobile version for free, right? Because it was more complicated to charge money for it, so the dev was just like, just take it.
Or like, look at the success of the newest card-like rogue-like game, Balatro.
Yeah.
That game blew up and like sold like millions of copies, and it was like 30 something bucks. And now the developers like hard at work on a mobile version because they know it's like they can put it on a mobile version and make more money.
So. Yeah.
But I guess it's just like my thoughts on like the weird capitalist aspect of all of this somewhere.
Yeah.
But for the most part, roguelikes are just, they're fun. They're really enjoyable games that, like, you know, it's sometimes they're like turn my brain off games. Like I can just like fire up Slay the Spire and just like do a couple of runs and just be like, okay, you know, I'm satisfied.
Yeah, there's a comfort to them.
Yeah, there is. So. Well, you know, I guess this about wraps up the episode. You know, this was our episode about Rogue. Our one-year anniversary episode. Thanks everybody so much for who have listened to us for the last year. We really appreciate it. I've seen like I've taken random screenshots of our numbers sometimes, and like we're not here to like try and get numbers and get like crazy famous. We literally like we enjoy video games a lot, and it's something fun for both of us to talk about. This all just started because the folks at AYCH asked me about like doing show stuff, and I reached out to Michael because we have two different completely backgrounds, but we're able to like create something really fun together. Yeah. And you know, we're going to keep rolling. We got more stuff to cover.
Here's to another year.
Yeah. Next month we get into a really fun topic as we talk about the video game crash. Yeah. And then, beyond that, we've got a couple of like weird episodes. We've kicked around a few ideas for some stuff. Who knows what we'll do in our June off month episode and our August off month episode. But we're going to be trudging to the 80s through the rest of the year. We've got the video game crash, and then we're going to do some little side steps here and there. We're going to talk about Japanese video game development during the 1980s, as well as computer home development during the 1980s. And then, you know, like I said, we might be talking about this small indie company called Nintendo. So. Yeah. But again, thanks everybody for tuning in or for listening. I was like still in streamer mode. So I guess we'll do our socials. We'll wrap it up. And then, So Michael, where can the folks find you?
Once again, on Instagram, I am mackerel_prawns, like the fish and like the crustacean.
All right.
And that's it.
Yeah. And for folks that don't, who have listened to the last episode or curious, Michael also was on a guest on In Bed with Books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I should mention that again, too. My friend Melissa and one of my ongoing D&D players has a podcast called In Bed with Books. She covers a bunch of stuff as far as like book talk, Bookstagram, you know, like dark adult fantasy content. And I recently was on her podcast to do some talking about tabletop role-playing games and kind of the overlap between the D&D community and like, you know, books, book talk and Bookstagram and that kind of whole fan base. So that was cool. Check it out. Give her a watch. And I think it's on YouTube as well. You can either find that episode on Spotify or you can go on YouTube and you can watch us and our actual faces because we're in a Zoom call.
Yeah, you can actually see what Michael looks like. I, on the meantime, am going to stay like low profile.
Yes.
I guess for me, you can find me on Instagram and Facebook for my art at PressArtF4, like Alt-F4, but it's Art-F4. I'm also on Cajun Greatness. We're back. By this time, our episode about Between Worlds came out, and I probably have not recovered from that. We also watched Dream Scenario, which was awesome. Way better than Between Worlds, so please go and watch that, or listen to that. And, yeah, you can also find us, the instruction booklet, here. We're on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. I tried to make an Instagram, and it flagged us as spam. Don't know why that happened.
That was interesting.
We also have a link tree. It's a linktr.ee/instruction booklet. That's where you can find all these links that we're talking about. We're also on Twitch. We don't have a schedule yet. We had a lot of fun streaming. We got a lot of folks watching, which we're also thankful for that. And we plan on doing more in the future. We might try and work out a fun schedule. We'll see how it goes. Right now, we're just kind of shooting from the hip. But it's twitch.tv/theinstructionbooklet. Give us a follow. Click the little notification bell so you know if we decide one night like to go do wild and do something fun. And as always, we're also on the AYCH network. They're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. I think it's YouTube now. I think Google got rid of their podcast thing. Anywhere where you can find them. We're also, our streaming stuff is being uploaded to the AYCH YouTube. So you can watch us play Rogue and some of the other games that we've played, because I've been transporting those over. So again, big thanks to everybody who's listened for the last year. Thanks to the network for putting up with us. Thanks for being a fun co-host, Michael.
Yeah.
And, you know, also thanks to our editor who makes our show sound great and writes our theme song and also plays Hell's Divers with us.
Yes, he certainly does.
Yep. So, yeah. So tune in next month for the video game crash. And yeah, we'll talk to y'all next time.
Yep. See you guys. Thank you.